Hello, and welcome to Bible Truth Feed. We have a lovely podcast for you right now. It's called The Providence of God in My Life, and it's a personal testimony by Brother John Martin, who was interviewed back in 2015 about how he first came across the truth and decided to become a Christadelphian. Not having been brought up in a religious family, it's quite a remarkable story. And I'm sure many of us who were not brought up as Christadelphians can relate to his message. It's a very, very interesting interview given by Brother Charles Taylor, his good friend. So we hope that you enjoy it. Please feel free to share. And if you have any comments, as always, please leave us a message or leave them in the comments area. Hope you enjoy it. Thank you. Bye-bye.
John, for having us at your place, and thanks for making some time available to have a chat with us.
Pleasure, Charlie.
Excellent. John, this is a little bit about your history and who you are and where you've come from and where you've been and perhaps even where you're going. So, can we start at the very beginning? When and where were you born, and who were your parents?
I was born at Mount Barker, 1931, and my parents were Mr. and Mrs. Martin, I suppose. I guess they were.
I guess so, yes. But who were they? What were they? Were they, what sort of work?
Well, my dad worked on the railway. He was what they call a ganger. You probably, old-fashioned times, you see them pumping the thing along the rails.
Yep.
Half a dozen fellas who'd go along fixing up the lines and that sort of thing.
And mum?
And we lived at Woods, and we lived at Woodside. But I was born at Mount Barker, but
right.
We did live at Woodside at that time, yeah.
Right. And mum a stay-at-home mum?
Oh, yeah, too, yep. Right she, okay, was. Cool. Yeah.
And you grew up, in what area did you grow up through your early adolescent years?
What?
Your early years, where did you grow up, in Mount Barker? Or
no, in Woodside. We lived in Woodside,
right.
Yeah.
Woodside Primary School?
Yeah, I was the third to last child. Mum had 10 children.
10?
Yeah, I had two brothers, and then all the rest was, and me. Oh, it's four. There was four brothers, Bob, right, and myself, and the two elder brothers. And then, right, there was all the rest were the girls.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And growing up in that environment, was it a Christian family or was it?
I wouldn't call you. Well, I suppose your dad would be nominally Christian. My mother was a very good-living person. My dad was a very difficult person.
Right.
Yeah. He was extremely difficult. But gave my mother a hard time. He wasn't violent, like he threatened violence, but he. My father was the only one in the world that was important. we grew up in a family where we just had to keep quiet. We weren't permitted to speak at the table or anything.
Right.
We just had to listen to how great Dad was. And,
yeah.
And everything else.
Did that shape you in any way?
Not really, because we didn't have a very happy time there, because we would be sitting in the passage at night with rugs around us outside the bedroom door while Dad was in there with an axe threatening to kill Mum because she was on with the baker or the butcher. He was sort of, right, very insanely jealous of my mother.
Okay.
But he was in many ways a very good father, in other ways, in, yeah, the way that he cared. He had a real conscience about providing for his family.
Right.
He did, yeah. He had his good points.
Through all those years, when do you recall the first time you went to a church or a meeting?
Oh, I could tell you the whole story in no time. See, that's probably, we bridged that gap up there, because we came down to Adelaide when I was about, I don't know, maybe grade 3 or 4, I don't know, I can't remember, I was only a kid. And so we lived at North Adelaide and grew up in North Adelaide. And then what happened, when I was about 13 or four, about 40 or something, I was very young, 14 or 15, I started playing football for the local football team here in the Northern Districts. And at that time, my sister Betty was, there was two elder brothers, Huey, Lionel, and then Dorothy, the elder sister, then Betty was next. My sister Betty was a very intense person. Whatever Betty did, she was very intense about it. She's the mother of Jim and Ron Cowie.
Right.
Yeah. And anyway, she would get interested, for example, one thing, she was a fad for film stars, so she'd have albums on film stars, you know, who they were. Then it was racehorses. She could tell you every Melbourne Cup winner, the time it ran, the jockey that rode, the weight that it carried. She could tell you a lot of it. You know, she'd do it very methodically. And for some reason or other, she's embarked on a crusade to find the truth of religion. Now, at this time, we didn't care for that. I mean, none of us. She was, Bet was Betty, you know, she was intense and she had her ways. But anyway, she would be up and backwards and forwards from, we lived at Kilburn, and she was going to Adelaide on Sunday nights to churches and interviewing ministers, notebook and everything. That's Betty. Charlie, we lived in a street where the bus turned in there, and we were about three houses down on the left. He'd virtually stop in front of our house and turn around and go back to town. That was the end of the line.
Right.
And she would be on that bus Sunday nights coming home. And of course, in those days, Sunday, even in the afternoon, you could drive a car down the road and not see another one.
Yeah.
And no one on the Sunday night, there'd only be a few people on the bus. And she was getting off the bus that night, the particular night. The driver said to her, he said, young lady, he said, I notice you on this bus quite regularly on Sunday night. He said, what would a young lady like you be doing, you know, going to town on Sunday night? She turned around, she said, if you must know, she said, I'm looking for the truth of religion. He said, sit down, you found it. He was a Christadelphian.
Wow.
Now, can you believe that? You tell me there's no God?
Yeah.
Anyway, to cut a long story short, Bet then came into the truth. All right? Now, I'm 16 years by this time. And this is quite a story. Sorry, I hope we don't go over time, but I'll abbreviate it. I'm 16. Now, I've been playing in the district football here, and I'd won the medal for this whole area for the year, for the best and fairest. And I got an invitation to go to play for North Adelaide Colt football. In those days, there was Colts B grade and A grade. Yeah. So I was up there playing with the Colts, and we play Saturday morning, and it was mandatory for us to go to the afternoon game where the league was playing. Now, by this time, Betty had married this guy called Cowie, and I think some stupid religion crazy, you know. And I was a lad of the world, and, you know, I couldn't care less. And anyway, that's Betty. So we're off to the Colts. So this particular day, we'd played somewhere, but the North Adelaide, who I was affiliated with, was playing on the Norwood Oval that afternoon, the senior game, and because it was mandatory that we go to that. That's part of your training,
yep.
You see. You don't go to that. You're not at the Colt football.
Yeah.
So anyway, I said to me, mate, we'll go. I said, my sister lives out there. This was Dorothy's house was at Norwood. And I didn't realise at that stage that she'd become, I think I knew a bit about that she'd been talking to Betty. But
yeah.
I was a lad. I was completely selfish. I didn't care less for what my kids, girls were doing. But my sister lives out there. Oh, I don't think I'd ever been to the place. Said to me, mate, my sister lives just down from the Oval. I said, we're going out there and get a bite to eat. She'll give us a bit of dinner and we'll go to the footy. So I went down to this house, and it was an old-fashioned house with a narrow front, with a very long house, and the passage went from the front door right down to the kitchen. Never forget it. So we went out there and had our lunch, and, you know, and me and me mate, and finished dinner. I said, well, see you later, thanks for dinner, and we're going to go out the door. So I'm walking down the passage. And as I'm walking down the passage, Betty followed me, because she was visiting Dot. I didn't know she was there. So Bet was there, you see. So she follows us down the passage, me and my mate. When we got to the front door, she got me by the shoulder and pushed me against the wall. I said, what are you doing? What is that? She said, you listen to me. She said to me, she talked about God. She said that God, that he's the God of the Jewish people, that the Jews are his people, that they're going to go. But this is in 1946, Charlie. You think of that.
Yeah.
46. And she tells me that the Jews are going to go back there, then that Britain would take them back to the land, that there'd be the rise of Russia would threaten those people in the land, and there'd be an invasion, and they'd nearly destroy the Jewish people, and that at the last minute, they were almost exterminated. Jesus Christ is going to return to the earth, and he's going to absolutely crush the nations and set up the kingdom of God on earth. It's about time I thought about it. Now, I'm going to say something that's going to be recorded, and I know people find it hard to believe. But I'll tell you here and now, I believe that with every fibre of my being. And I've got no reason to why I believed it.
Yeah.
I knew that was right.
Yeah.
And no one could have told me from that second on that it was wrong.
Yeah.
I went to that football game in a daze. I was absolutely I was just in a daze. So I immediately went up to their place. They lived at Tea Tree Gully, which was country in those days, vineyards. And I said to Arthur, you know, Arthur Cowie, I had never spoken to him hardly, you better tell me more about this. I was only a kid, 16,
yeah.
Mad on footy. And I went up there and I gave up footy. But it only lasted for I used to go up on the weekends. It lasted about 2 or 3 weeks and I couldn't stand it. So I jumped the fence when Arthur wasn't looking. We were out picking strawberries in his strawberry patch. And I rushed in, got my bag, shoved my pyjamas in. I used to go and sleep up the weekend. Jumped the fence, which in those days was just a hop, step and jump for me. And then down to the bus and caught the bus home. Went back to footy for 6 years.
Wow.
And I lived agony in those 6 years. In the meantime, I made the A grade and all sorts of things. Had trophies for footy and everything. And it was I loved football, but... I was in agony. I could never explain it to you. I'd go to blooming drunken parties and everybody, I'd get drunk and I'd be sitting in the corner just miserable and just absolutely broke because I knew that when Christ came, I was finished.
Yeah.
I'd go to the pictures and, you know, in those days you used to show the newsreel. Have you ever seen those things go? And they always a newsreel comes up about the daily news. Imagine me sitting in the theater, some town in theatre in Adelaide, sitting there one day, and up comes the British ships pulling into Haifa Harbour with Jews on them.
Yeah.
I'm sitting in my chair petrified. I'm absolutely terrified watching this. This is what my sister said. British ship. She said Britain would take them back. Here they come, jumping off the thing and swimming to the shore. You know, all this. So all this was happening. At any rate, this went on and on and on. And then in 1949, I was still playing Colt football at 49. I was 18 then. And we went top and we played on the... And we used to, in those days, we used to play the precursor on the oval before the big league grand final. Because grand final time, the stands were packed and thousands of people there. And we playing the precursor to the game and we won by 2 points. And I can never forget this. We won by 2 points, and when the siren went, the crowd went mad. All our trainers and coaches come running out and everything. The boys were in tears, everybody, and I'm in tears, and I'm crying for a different reason. And I can take you to the spot at the northern end of the cricket pitch on the Adelaide Oval where I stood there and saw this sea of faces around. I've got tears running down my eyes, and I just looked up at the stands and I quoted the words of Solomon, "All is vanity. All is vanity," says Solomon. You know, and I knew it was empty. We're top. You got in by 2 points. Mm-hmm. It was a real game and a half. We've won. We can't get any better. And I just said, "So what?"
Yeah.
And I just said to myself, and I always felt so lonely. So anyway, from there, trying to jump a few years, it got to a point where I made the A grade training list. They have trial games. They have about 400. They invite 400 participants all around the district, plus their own training squad, of course. You play trial games, and they all sit up there adjudicating whether you're going to make the one of the 30. You had 30 on the training list. And so I got this letter saying, you know, you either saying, sorry, we don't need you, thanks for your participation, or the letter said, we require you at the Prospect Oval, and you're on the training list. So I made the training list. I don't think it was about 1952, I think it was. And I had played B grade up to then. Then I made that. And I had to go up and we had to present ourselves at the Prospect Oval. And And what had to happen, you had to dress up in the togs they sent you and make sure that the white laces were squared across and you'd iron them, all this sort of guff. And we had to stand on that oval in a line, 30 of us, you know, and there's Ian McKay there with Gary Medless and Roddy Phillips and a few others. And you're all lined up with these guys. And here comes our coach, Ken Farmer. And he was a man about 6'4". At that time, he was an old man. He'd retired, of course. He was a coach. And he holds the record for South Australian goal kicking and never be beaten. He's miles ahead, you know. He had a big point to it, and he was an arrogant fanatic. You know, they're all fanatic. It's professionalism, you know. And he lined us up, and he just came out, folded his hands like this, looked at us scornfully as if you're the scum of the earth. And then he just put his head down, and he strode along in front of us like that, up and down, up and down, up and down. We thought he'd never stop. Psychology. So when he got, you know, when we were all looking at sideways at each other, he'd folded hands, what's going on here? Next minute, he gets down the end of the line, he swings on his feet, he grabbed the first fella by the jumper, pulled him right up like that, and sat him on. He had a big paunch, he used to sit him on his stomach, and he'd have your nose like that, and he'd say, you're going to eat, sleep, and drink football. See? Now, he had a different spiel for every player. Now, he never knew me from a bar of soap. He knew my name, perhaps he had to know that. I'd never been near him. I'd never shaken his hand, never spoken to him. He knew nothing. None of those knew anything about my private life. And when he got to me, he lifted me up, and I was only a little guy by comparison. And he sat me on his stomach, and this is what he said. He said, as for you, this is going to be your religion. And he knew nothing about me. That was like someone shooting me in the chest. When he put me down, I could hardly stand. My legs were jelly like that. I was nearer to breaking point at that point of 6 years. I couldn't have gone much further. Anyway, cut a long story short, it all came to a head. I was a truck driver, and I'm sitting out on the truck, Port Rush Road. Bit back from the Paynham intersection, quite a busy intersection. I'm under a tree having my lunch. And Arthur Cowie was a truck driver. And he pulled up alongside of me. Now, I dodged Arthur and Betty for 6 years. If they come home and see Mum, I'd go out the back door. If they come the back door, I'd go out the front. I couldn't face them. I could not face them. Anyway, he parked there, leant across in his truck, and he said, how you going? I said, oh, okay. Now, this is the other kind. And I got the newspaper on the steering wheel. And I was reading that paper, and what I used to love to read in those days was the beginning of the Geneva conferences on peace in the world, and I loved that. I knew that when war came, I was out, I had it. Yeah. Peace was my anchor. And I got this thing on the steering wheel. And Arthur's a man of very few words. He's a very shy, quiet man. And he I can tell you almost the exact conversation. He leant over and he said, how you going? I said, oh, how you going? Not too bad. I didn't even look at him. I thought, darn him, you know. Anyway, he then said to me, I hear you're reading Bible every night. Now, I had a Bible, and I used to put it under my mattress, but Mum must have found it, and she must have told him. And I worked that out quickly, and I thought, yeah. And there's another pause. He said, that's good. I said, is it? He said, yes. That's how the conversation's going. There's another pause. And then he said, that's interesting what you're reading there. Is it? Yes. Why? He said, because it says in the Bible that before Christ comes, there'll be a peace and safety crying. Well, the dam burst. So while I'm out here at Paynham, I'm about 10, 12 miles from my work at Dry Creek. I just slammed the lunch in my bag, everything went everywhere. Slammed it in the truck into gear, drove back to work, went into my boss, threw my notes on the table, and he was a lovely fella, my boss, and he was a wonderful man, not a Christian, but he was a good fella. And I said, Tom, I'm going home, I'm upset, don't worry me, please. And I ran across the warehouse, and he's a much older man than me, but he followed, and he sang out to me, John, stop. There was nobody there, because all the boys out on the road, you know, there's about 10 drivers we had. And I said, Tom, I want to go home. He said, John, wait a minute, hang on, well, you wait. I said, I want to... Hey, John, hang on. And he walked up to me. And he put his hand on my shoulder in the middle of that empty warehouse. And he looked at me and he said, it's religion, isn't it? How do they know? How would they ever know? I said, it is, Tom. He said, well, you go home, I'll see you tomorrow. And that was it. But I went straight up to Arthur and Bitter and said, that's enough. I gave it all up. That was it.
That was 1952.
1952. Then I was baptised in 53.
Who took you through for your baptism, John?
Well, Arthur taught me, right. But brother Jolly, old brother Jolly, who also married us, he took me through for baptism. Yeah.
And after you're baptised, do you remember how long it was before you gave your first talk?
Yeah, I can. It was in Young Folks, and there was quite an experience because.
So you're baptised in 1953.
53. It must have been around. See, we would have gone out of Adelaide by. See, in 1954, Enfield started as a lecture effort. In those days, people did things properly. No, they did. If you wanted to start a new ecclesia, the procedure was you take your request to the AB. They'd ask you how many people you had and, you know, are they all keen to go? Yes. Well, they would suggest that where do you want to go? When you were the northern area, there was no ecclesia. Well, that'll be good. Now, we suggest you start a lecture effort and then you're still members of Adelaide Ecclesia, but you start a lecture effort and they would send two senior brethren out with you on Sunday night just to see how you went. And if you, after a few years or whatever time, you shook down, you filled, you could be an ecclesia, then you'd merge into an ecclesia. So it wasn't until 1957 we became an ecclesia. And we had Brother Alan Dangerfield and Brother Gordon Walker were the two brethren who came out to be with us. You couldn't ask for two finer brethren. And they worked with us for that time. So that's how it happened. But you take about my first talk was at Young Folks when John Knowles was Secretary of the Young People. And I'll never forget him coming to say to me that I want to give a talk at Young Folks. Now, that's like saying to you, Charlie, you're next man on the moon.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because yeah. I'd never get... the only talks I'd ever give in my life were... I had a lot of football trophies. Thanks very much, you know.
Yeah.
that was a sum total. And I was not a brilliant student. I got through, but I never went past grade... about third year in technical school, and I did reasonably well, I suppose, but nothing marvellous.
Yeah.
Just managed to get by. And I had no ambitions to be like that. So I said to John Knowles, but I had this idealistic view at that time, which I hope I still got in measure, that I had to do all I was asked to do. That I had that view. Like, I wouldn't refuse anything. Yeah. But when he asked me, I was astonished. I said, I don't, what do you want me to talk about? Oh, we want you to talk about as it was in the days of Noah. So I thought, gee whiz, you know, I'm thinking the young people, they're all brought up in Sunday school and I'm just out of the waters of baptism. And I was as nervous as a kitten because we had a big Adelaide Ecclesia at that stage numbered about 670 people. It was a huge Sunday school and youth group. So I get up and anyway, when I got into this story, I just read it up and did a bit of study on it. I got thrilled with it, you know, and I lost all my sort of feelings of shine. I couldn't wait to tell the kids about this, you see. But I thought to myself, oh, this can't be that stupid because they've been brought up in the brotherhood and they'll think this is an old hat and it'll be boring.
Mm.
I was amazed at the reaction.
Yeah. John, you've clearly got a reputation as a speaker and as an elder brother around Australia and around the world. And over those 60 years, if you had your time over, would you do anything differently?
Yeah, I would. I'd do. Would I do anything differently? No, I don't suppose I would. You'd probably. I would have travelled a lot more if I didn't have my problem. I would dearly give anything to be able to go back to America and Canada, to help over there.
Right.
But I've got a problem with flying, and I'm ashamed of it, and I can't overcome it. Right. I had a very bad experience in an aeroplane, and it really, really fixed me, really. I flew a lot of time. I flew many, many miles afterwards,
right.
But at great expense. And now I'd find it very difficult to do.
Right.
It's a phobia.
It's not a health issue, it's a phobia?
Well, it is. And I'm ashamed of it because I should have the faith to overcome that.
Yeah, it's hard, isn't it? The
but I had a very bad experience in a plane and I never got over that.
Right.
there. It was had a, yeah, just at a turbulent sort of thing. But it was, it came at the end of an Israel tour, my first Israel tour.
With my dad.
With your dad. Yeah, he was on that trip. Mm. And we left Israel in a very emotional state. I'm a very emotional person, yeah. And I remember getting on the plane feeling very, very funny.
Right.
And we had some pretty violent turbulence and so forth, and I just lost it. I really did, and I couldn't. I just lost it. I wanted to give talks in that plane.
Yeah.
I wanted to stand up and tell them all about the Bible, and they had to sit me down. And
right.
It was very, very. It was a terrible. I flew a lot out that, but gee, it cost me a lot.
Yeah.
That cost me a lot.
Yeah.
So yes, if I had time over again, I would have liked to have gone more regularly to overseas to meet people, you know, because I really found the Brotherhood's a wonderful place. It,
yeah.
People overseas are just overwhelmed. It's like your own family, you know,
yeah.
They're just
yeah.
marvellous.
Yeah.
I love that.
Just another thought here. Are you of the opinion that brothers and sisters generally understand the grace of God? Do you think they really
oh look I think that's true Charlie. I can't help but thinking most old people would agree with me that we've lived in two different worlds. You see, like in our day, like at our age now, things that happen really shock us mm. to the core, because they're unheard of in my day. Like, I get the young people, I talk to them about the seriousness of the age in which we live, and it's not their fault. See, they get used to it. See, we're not used to it, and it shocks us, but they're used to it. And you get comments from young people like, oh, Uncle John, you know, those things were the same in your day. I said, you'd have to be kidding. And I quote them an example. I said, I can tell you it must have been around about 1953, just after my baptism. I said, I was standing outside the temple in Adelaide when we had a ecclesia of 600 members, and we used to congregate on the front, you know, as a bit of a area in the front of the hall, Halifax Street there, and the place would be packed after the meeting on a nice day, and they're all chatting around, and I said, a brother put my hand on my shoulder and said, do you see that brother over there in the corner, right over there by the wall, John? I said, yeah. He said, that's the divorce brother. The divorce brother. I said, he was known all over Australia. Now, I said, you wouldn't know who's married, let alone divorced. I said something else. I said, look, you say it's the same. Yes, we did have problems, but we weren't perfect.
Mm.
But I had never, ever, ever heard of couples being divorced in their late 20s and 30s.
Mm.
Never heard of it.
Yeah.
That would send shockwaves through the Brotherhood. Mm. Now, you wonder who's going to be next.
Yeah.
And that's the problem.
Yeah.
You know?
I guess in raising that subject of grace, from my point of view, when I reflect on my youth, there tended to be more an emphasis on the things to do. You know, like, you have to do this, you have to do that, you have to do that. And grace didn't seem to be spoken about in the context that we understand it. It was more, you know, make sure you...
Yeah, but Charlie, I think it's a good question. You see, you've raised a very good question, and this would be the major... Look, if I, as in this interview, you're asking me to summarise things
yep.
for you. We could talk at length about details, but to me, to bring it down to a nutshell, it's not the lack of the grace in the Brotherhood that I would see. I think the major, by far the major problem, is the lack of the acknowledgement of God's righteousness first. That's the big problem today. Now, you see, an ecclesiast, therefore, who take a firm stand on what is right, are looked upon as extreme, and some are extreme. I'm not saying there's not. I don't agree with some of the extremes in the Brotherhood. But it's not extreme to insist that before anything can be done for anyone, for yourself or anyone, we must put our Heavenly Father first. And all these arguments on the atonement, you know, really, when I was younger, I'd argue the ins and outs of that. But look, it's so simple. Paul says in Romans 3, to put it in the vernacular, we all understand. He said, Jesus died to prove that his Father was right. He said he declared God's righteousness. What was it? That he had human nature. That's the nature that is now prone to sin. Not because God made it that way, but sin made it that way. And because it's prone to sin, God doesn't want to perpetuate that nature. It's not worthy of perpetuation. His Son went to the cross to say to the whole human race, that nature is dragging you to the grave. Was my Father right in saying it's going to die? He's dead right, and that's why I'm going to die. So he had to die. Jesus did. He had to die to prove his Father right. Once that done, Charlie, grace and mercy and kindness and compassion knows no limit, but that's what's got to be done first.
Yeah.
Now, can I just venture to say as an example that we've got this present cursed doctrine of theistic evolution. Now, I'll just say something, and it may happen, or I may be in the grave. I don't believe that doctrine is going to be largely accepted by a large body of brotherhood. They're too simple-minded for that. They're too honest and simple for that, these people. What I fear above all else is when these people claim that, well, look, we'll keep quiet about it. It's our personal view, but we won't cause any trouble. If we keep quiet about it, you know, it's not a fellowship issue. That they're doing exactly what I've been telling you. They're saying God's righteousness doesn't matter. It's compassion and understanding that's necessary. It will not work. And God will see that it won't work because it's wrong. So we've got to get those people to say, God said, I made heaven and earth in 6 days and I rested on the seventh. Do you believe it or don't you? If you believe that, we can forgive all what you've done in the past. We can forget about all the nonsense that went on. But we can't do it without that. That's what I'm trying to tell you. And to me, that's the great lack today. And what I find, Charlie, is this. Just by observing, when you're an older person, you tend to think deep and think long. And just by observation, I find that everyone will curse humanism, and they all know what humanism is, but it is having its effect, and they can't see that. It is definitely having effect upon people. Because you dare criticise anyone for anything. You can do anything in the world you like, as long as you don't criticise him, you know. And now that attitude is creeping in where we're not seeing clearly as we used to see, that God is right. When we put God right, then everything else will go right. But it won't go if we don't. And that's what I think is the biggest danger.
Yeah.
And to me, I've seen that happening.
Yeah.
It worries me.
If there was only, apart from the Bible, if there was one book that you would recommend for studying or preparing studies and things like that outside of the Bible, what book would you go to?
I'd have no hesitation in answering that, because there is a set of books in our library which won't exhaust every subject, but it'll give you a start on almost every subject in the Bible. And that's Person's Story of the Bible. It is number one in my library.
Mm.
Not because I worship Percy Mansfield. He was my father in the truth. It's got nothing to do with that. But when I have these boys at School of the Prophets, Uncle John, I can't find anything on this subject. I say, have you read the story of the Bible? Now you won't. Percy, because it's the story of the Bible, told in childlike way, it's not going to be exhaustive in every subject. But I don't hardly know a subject in that that's not, you can't get a start in the story of the Bible. So when Charlie, I say this too, that as a warning to all the young people, young fellas especially, you know, this attitude that I'm going to do the study for myself first and then I'll have a look at these things, and I say that, well, you're an idiot. I tell them that, you are an idiot, because I can see a lot further when I stand on someone else's shoulders. And I said, if you went and get a driver's license, you wouldn't say to the tutor, stand aside one, I'll show you, I'll give it a go first, then you tell me afterwards. You'd probably finish up in hospital. I said, I drag down every thing written in the Pioneers about any subject I'm doing, and the story of the Bible is number one. And I read them all. I get all their ideas. Now I'm standing on their shoulders. I see a lot further. But that would be my first choice, yeah.
Well, You've been around a long time.
Yeah, 61 years now in the truth.
Who are your favourite speakers that you like listening to?
Charlie Taylor.
Well, excluding him, of course.
Look, it's very. We got a lot of good speakers, but I reckon that one of our most up and coming speakers at the moment is Carl Parry.
Right.
And I'll tell you another lad who's doing. Just I call him a lad, but he's grown up man. Who's Steve Mansfield is doing exceptionally good work at the moment. Stephen McGeorge does a very good job. There's a whole lot of people. There's a lot of good students around. But, Charlie, you'll find this. In 1 Corinthians 12, Paul gives all the gifts of the Spirit. Now, we're going on record, so I'll state categorically, I don't believe we've got the gifts of the Spirit. I don't intend to teach that. But I believe we've got the Spirit of the Spirit gifts, in the sense that when you look at the list in 1 Corinthians 12, there are prophets, apostles, pastors, tutors, teachers, and so forth. If you made a list of them today, we've got those brethren. There are brethren who expound the word, but there are another brother who's better at exhorting. He may not have the same depth of exposition, but he gives a better exhortation. And then you've got your teachers who are good at first principles. You know, and so on and so on. If you make a list of Paul's list, we're all gifted in one way or another. And I think it's the when you're coming to speaking work, you've got to be honest. You have to be honest with yourself. Honesty is a big thing. Personal honesty is a very big thing. You know, you've got young brethren aspiring to be something they never will be, but they've got a talent in another direction that they haven't recognised. You need to stand in front of a mirror and talk to yourself and say, now, what am I really good at? And don't say what you want to be good at.
Yeah.
It's what you are good at. It's what God made you.
Yeah.
Now, if I was to stand in front of a mirror, I want to be a reader. I love reading from the Bible. I love to give emphasis. But I'm a speaker. I found that out by accident. So I do that.
Yeah.
And I think that that's what we need today. We need honesty. And one of the things that it's against honesty, and this is another one of my gripes, so opportunity to leave a permanent record about John Martin's gripes, is that in our ecclesia years ago, when we had the ecclesial ballot came around, our ecclesia voted very intelligently. I was always amazed. The brethren and sisters were very intelligent. Now, tick, 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 tick. If you're nominated, you're on. That's not the fault of the brother. That's the fault of the brother and sister who put the ticks on the thing.
Yeah.
Now, people will say, oh, you know, John Martin, he just wants to do all the talking. I'm being honest. I don't want to do all the talking. But I want my ecclesia educated. Yeah. And the brethren and sisters should show more consideration as to who they tick and who they don't. And it's no shame to a brother if he can't make it. He's not fitted for that, but he might be a wonderful brother in another direction.
Yeah.
There's no reflection on the brother personally.
Yeah.
And one of the best class in our ecclesia by a country mile is the last Tuesday in every month we have the oldies meeting. We've got 94 there one month. But we have a reading, we do the daily reading, have our lunch, and then we talk in the afternoon about mission work mostly, where brother's been on mission work. And as a brother said, and I keep telling the people they ought to come, I said, it's the best class in the ecclesia. One brother said, why is it the best class in the ecclesia? I said, because we don't have a ballot for the speaking brethren. We don't have a bad talk.
Yeah.
Now, there's no reflection on the brethren. Mm. I don't wish to upset anyone.
Yeah.
But we've got to be honest. You've got to have people doing what they're cut out to do. And some people say, oh, yeah, well, speaking work's not everything. Well, if you took a percentage of your of the meeting you have, about 80% is up on that platform.
Yeah, isn't it? Yeah, it is.
So it is important. It is important to know the Word of God properly.
Yeah.
And we should have brethren equipped to that.
Yeah. In the kingdom, by the grace of God, who are you, apart from our Lord Jesus Christ, who are you most looking forward to meeting?
Oh, I have no hesitation whatever to answer that question. There's one brother, look, pardon me for saying this, there's one brother, I know him in and out, I know how he thinks, I know how he feels, he's the most wonderful person I know in the Bible apart from our Lord. And that's Paul. I love him. I love him dearly. And you know what I love him for? I love his honesty. He wrote Romans chapter 7. He told the whole world in that epistle, my mind's full of evil concupiscence, which is perverted thinking. He told us. He told us that. You know, the things that I would do, I don't do. The things I hate, that I do. I'm a wretched person. He's the most honest person. I just love him dearly. I just love him dearly. There's no question in my mind, apart from our Lord, he's the first person I want to talk to. I really think I could sit there with Paul and feel perfectly at home to understand. I'm not someone like him, but I just know how he thinks. You know, when I'm reading his word, I could almost finish the chapter. It's just, I have a terrific rapport with his thinking. I really do. I love him. Just love him to bits. Yeah.
I know the kingdom's coming quickly.
Pardon?
I know the kingdom's coming quickly. And you know, we're anticipating the return of Christ.
Well, I'll just give it, just before we finish, just tell you something else. What would be my perfect vision? What's my greatest vision?
I was going
to
ask you that.
Well, Charlie, I'll tell you what my perfect vision is. It's based on Zechariah chapter 8. And that is this, that you imagine this happening. And this, in my mind, is genius. I reckon this is genius developed over thousands of years. Absolute genius. That if you wanted to Jesus comes and if he wanted to humiliate and flatten all people's ego in the world to a common level, just flatten everyone's ego, because ego is a terrible thing. We're all full of it. I'm full of it. Everyone is. To flatten that ego, what would you do? Well, I'll tell you what you'd do. You'd make yourself king of the world. There's a beautiful temple in Jerusalem, a throne up there, and there's no governments, there's no House of Representatives or Lords, there's no committees, there's no parties. The government's going to be upon his shoulder, no one else's. So the world says, I've got to see this one king. How do I get there? You've got to go and see a Jew. I'm dying to see that. You imagine. Now you just think the genius of that. What would you do in one single blow to flatten everyone's ego? How do I get to see this wonderful king? He's a marvelous king. I'd love to go. Well, go and see that Jew over there. You have to be joking. A Jew. Now, Zechariah doesn't say an Israelite. He doesn't say a Hebrew. They shall take hold of the skirt of him that is a Jew. The contemptuous word. I reckon that's marvellous. You think of the genius of that. Now, to do that over centuries of time, through circumstance of history, that's been created in people's minds. There's nothing more stinking on this earth than a Jew. Well, if you want to see Christ, you've got to go with him. And you only got to go with him because he has repented. Absolutely. Genuinely.
Yeah.
He's not what you think he is now. He's a genuine repentant Jew. That's one of my chief visions of the kingdom, just to stand and watch that happen. And the people just mouths fall open and realize what has happened.
Now I have two more questions for you. Given where we are in this period of time, how do you think brothers and sisters in the ecclesias are travelling in relationship to preparing for the kingdom of God? How are the ecclesias and the brothers and sisters going in our preparation for the kingdom? Do you think we're tracking okay, or do you think we've lost our way a bit?
Well, of course, everyone our age thinks it was better in our time, I suppose, because we lived through that time. But I think you do have worries. There's big issues in America at the moment, which over 120 years of division, which could have been healed if people had done the right thing, is now going to be trying to brush over as if it never happened. Well, that sort of thing. You see, that's what I'm saying again. God first. But I still think that everywhere. I don't travel much. I can't. But before I gave up travel, all I know is that everywhere I went, I found marvellous people. I really did. I could only say that truly.
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't do things all together what you like when you do it, but it doesn't matter in many cases. But when it really matters, there are some pretty wonderful people in this world, really. Oh, yeah, I think the truth's holding up to a degree. I think mission work's done us a lot of good. It's taught us that, you know, we can't altogether do what we'd like it our way always,
yeah.
But there's some wonderful people.
I think mission work does open our eyes to.
Well, I've only been to the Philippines. Like, I've only been there twice, but that's hardly mission work because there's nearly 1,000 Christadelphians and they're well equipped to preach the truth.
Yeah.
But what we saw over there was greatly impressed us.
And where was this?
Philippines. Yeah.
So just a final thought to close with, and again, this might be your last opportunity to talk to the brothers and sisters via this medium. What's your comments, your parting comments for the...
Pardon?
Your final comments and parting thoughts for the brothers and sisters who are watching this.
Well, I think you'd have to say, you know, I would like everybody to picture in their mind that whatever we do, we see Jesus on that cross. You know, there's a lot of appeal in that. There's a lot of drama and poignancy about that, and it's heartrending. But he's there to tell the world, whatever you do, my Father is right. And that to me is everything. Just, we should judge everything like that. We should look at every issue and say, now, let's first of all establish God's principle and then we'll work through. Let's do that first. And that's what he did first. He declared his Father to be right. See, the statement in Romans declared God's righteousness is a little bit ambiguous if you just leave it like that. But just picture it as saying, my Father's right about this. It's a terrible thing that's happening, but he's right. He's not wrong in doing this. This nature's no good. Let's admit it. Let's be honest. And then we do that, then after that, well, we can... Mercy and compassion and everything is so important. I'm not against that at all. I think it's wonderful. But I don't like to see that running riot without that principle, because I know it's not going to go right. In the end, it's going to be disastrous.
Yeah.
I'd like to see the whole brotherhood stand up and say, God is right, and we'll work everything out like that. And I think in Mass they do that. But sometimes it's overlooked because of compassion and understanding and love and all that thing that sometimes put before that. And that's not always good.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm a hard person. I'm not. But I do believe that's where you've got to start.
John, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah,
thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Yes. Really, really love chatting to you.
Yeah.
And,
the whole time.
I know. I don't really do anything like that, but appreciating you.